Okay. Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for Adeo Charter School Nonprofit Board, which operates Adeo 2 Charter School, Adeo Charter School 3, Adeo Valley Charter School, Grossmont Secondary School, Mira Secondary School, and Sweetwater Secondary School. I'm Greg Haggard, Chairman of the Board. I will facilitate the meeting. Let's take the roll first. When I call your name, please provide the group with a brief introduction for the benefit of new members and members of the public. So item 1.2, roll call, Laura Barrero.
Laura Barrero, board member.
Thank you. Waylon Myers.
Waylon Myers, also a board member.
Christina Stevens.
Christina Stevens, board member.
And Jim Herr, guest board member. I don't see him here. And Chris Gordon, guest board member, future board member. Don't see him here. Okay, so we do have all the board members here, the current board member. So 1.3, consideration approval of adoption of the board findings pursuant to government code section 54953E1. The Adeo Charter School Board of Directors determines in accordance with government code section 54953E1B that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health or safety of attendees. Pursuant to government code section 54953E3, the board has also reconsidered the circumstances of the state of emergency declared by the governor on March 4th, 2020, and finds the state of emergency continues to directly impact the ability of directors to meet safely in person and or that state or local officials continue to impose or recommend measures to promote social distancing. Additionally, AB 361 requires this finding be made every 30 days to continue to permit teleconference meetings without adhering to some of the traditional requirements of the Brown Act, specifically with the teleconference requirements of government code section 54953B3. Do I have a motion for approval of this item 1.3?
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we approve item 1.3.
Waylon Myers, I second that motion.
Thank you. And I'm going to call for your vote. So Laura Barrero.
Laura Barrero, aye.
Waylon Myers.
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina Stevens.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Greg Haggard is aye. That passes unanimously. So 1.4, establishment of quorum. Do I have a motion for approval of item 1.4?
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we approve item 1.4.
Your turn, Christina.
Christina Stevens, I second that motion.
Thank you. And Laura, your vote, please.
Laura Barrero, aye.
Waylon.
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And I am an aye. So that is that passes unanimously. So the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you, Angela, for bringing the flag.
Yes, Angela.
Okay. Ready? Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. So item 1.6, approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion for approval of today's agenda?
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we approve today's agenda.
Waylon Myers, I second that motion.
All right, and Laura Barrero, your vote, please.
Laura Barrero, aye.
Waylon.
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina.
Christina Stevens, aye.
All right, Greg Haggard is aye, so that passed unanimously. 2.0, public comment. Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of the Adeo Charter School Inc. Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In meetings held over Zoom, any person who wishes to make a comment on either non-agenda or agenda items shall use the raise hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may equivalently decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. 2.1, non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? Hearing none, seeing nothing, I'm going to move along to 2.2, agenda items, public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on agenda items?
Not that we're aware.
Don't see anything, don't hear anything. We're going to move along. Thank you. So 3.0, board workshop training. Young, Minnie, and Core Law Firm will provide training to the board regarding professional development training, including best practices and charter schools board management, updates on the Charter Schools Act, and a review of corporate practices, fiduciary duties, and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act, and conflict of interest laws. Thank you. This is part two of the training that we had 2 weeks ago. I really appreciate it. And with that, I'll turn it over to Paul for introduction.
Thank you, Board Chair. I appreciate it. Again, Paul Minnie with Young, Minnie, and Core. I'm joined by my colleague, Kayla Haydu. And we will try to split up part two of our presentation. You might recall last time we talked about the overview of Charter Schools Act, fiduciary duties, how to operate as a board, best practices, the Brown Act. And then we talked a lot about the changes, the recent changes to the Brown Act. And then today we're going to start back on conflicts of interest law, which is the second of three parts of the state's transparency law for public agencies, the third part being the Public Records Act, which we're not going to cover in detail today. But if anybody has any questions about the Public Records Act, I'm happy to answer those. It's just that, well, I should say two things about the Public Records Act before we start. One is that almost all records of your organization are considered public records unless they are specifically exempt under the law, which would include student records, personnel records, and a few other items, litigation items, things like that. But for the most part, we have to assume that all communications, emails, and even text messages are public records. So as a word of caution, in choosing how to frame discussions and what you might say, always operate under the rule of thumb that what you say might become an attachment to a letter or a filing in the court of law. So with that in mind, just remember that. And we talk about in some of our other workshops, the Public Records Act actually covers communications with private emails and private phones if it relates to school-related activities. So something else to keep in mind. All right, let me make sure that I am properly sharing the screen. Let me know if I am now sharing the PowerPoint presentation and it says understanding conflict of interest laws. Great, thank you, Board Chair. I will change. I'll leave that like that. And we're still recording. Okay, good. So conflicts of interest in the state of California have been probably one of the areas of laws that have tripped up and led to notices of cure and revocations and non-renewals of more charters than almost any other area. And it's important to just start back with a broad concept of what a conflict of interest is. And then we'll talk about the specific laws, and then we'll actually talk about another broad concept called con law, conflict of interest. But conflict generally on the laws that we're going to be talking about, it arises when an individual, board member, employee, or otherwise, has a private financial interest in the outcome of the decision that's before the agency, and you participate or you try to influence or you actually act on that, that decision or that contract. And so a conflict of interest is a clash between the individual's duties and his or her office. And so you might recall in the first segment, we talked about fiduciary duties, duty of loyalty, duty of care, always operating in the best interest of the organization, and same thing, duty of care. And so when you violate conflict of interest laws, typically the law sees it as a violation of those fiduciary duties as well, because you may not be operating in the best interest of the organization. You might be compelled to act based upon your own private interests, be it financial or otherwise. But typically it's financial. And financial doesn't just include sources of income, it includes investments in business entities, investments in real property, sources of income. So could be public agencies, private agencies, in-state, out-of-state, internationally, source of gifts. So you can have a conflict of interest involving gifts, which we'll talk about, and effects on personal finances. And this includes you as board members and employees, and most often includes your immediate family members as well. So some of you might recall that Bill Honig, our former superintendent of the public instruction, got into trouble under some of these laws because he was responsible for a contract that went before the State Board of Education for curriculum materials for a company his wife worked for back in the day. So the main law that we often refer to, the most draconian law, the one that has the highest criminal penalties associated with it, is considered Government Code 1090. It applies to charter schools now through an express provision in the law. It applies to the board members and the employees of the organization, and it has three basic elements. If you are a public officer, either board member or employee or otherwise, and you are involved in the making of a public contract, so it's a public contract for sale or purchase of something, and you have a financial interest in that contract, mostly directly or indirectly, and you try to influence that action, or if you're a board member, actually take any action on that contract, you violate Government Code 1090. Problem about 1090 is if a board member has a financial interest in a contract before it, the board itself cannot take action on that contract without that board member resigning from the board. It's an absolute prohibition against the board acting on that contract. So if you were considering a lease of a building and a single board member owned a one or more, even small part of that building, then they would be financially interested in that contract and the board couldn't enter into that contract, even if the lease was for 1 cent a year. It would absolutely prevent the organization from entering into that contract. And it's defined very broadly. You can't be involved in the final decision. You can't be involved in negotiations. You can't even be involved in putting forth the idea. I always have to raise a hand if I hear someone having a conversation that might be 1090 and I say, well, we've got to stop. Don't talk about it. Don't mention it. The only way to discuss it would be to resign from the board. And I have actually had clients decide that one or more, it was in their best interest that one or more of the board members resigned so they could actually enter into a contract because there were facilities, for example, that was a good deal. Violation of 1090 is a felony and the contract is void and the school itself could be forced to repay or disgorge any monies they might have paid under the contract. We don't want to get into a 1090 conflict. There is another body of law that's referred to as the Political Reform Act that also influences and impacts decision-making outside contracts, contracts included. And the elements again are if you're a public official, board member, employee, or otherwise, and you're participating or attempting to influence a decision of your agency, and you have a qualifying financial interest, which we'll talk about in a little more detail in the next slides, but generally you have real property or income or business interest that you, your spouse, or your dependent children are involved in, and there's a financial interest in its material. And if those four elements are met, this law is a little more forgiving. Says, all right, you can raise your hand in the board and meeting and you can say, hey, I think I need to bow out. My spouse owns the, let's just say my spouse owns a share or interest in some company that might be providing some professional development training to your organization. You might be able to disclose and recuse yourself from those decision-making process. Lots of regulations adopted by the Fair Political Practices Commission, the FPPC, on how to implement and interpret the Political Reform Act. The important part about these slides and raising it is just to make you all as board members and officers and employees of the organization spot issues, make you aware of the potential clash, make you sensitive to the idea of what you can and cannot bring forward, which can and cannot be involved in. And if there were a contract, and sometimes these things are really subtle. We had a client in Northern California who owned a venture capital company, and he owned part of the company, and that company owned a bunch of educational companies like LearnZillion was one I remember off the top of my head. And he voted on contracts to renew the LearnZillion contract. Well, he didn't have any day-to-day involvement with LearnZillion, but then it comes to find out he technically owns a piece of LearnZillion. And so that was an issue that sort of crept up on people. So what we're trying to do here today is just make it so you can catch those things in advance. The Political Reform Act requires you to have a conflict of interest code, and you do. Your corporation does. The code itself delineates primarily categories of disclosure for designated employees. So board members, high-level decision makers for the organization, or anybody that might be able to influence or impact a contractual decision or a fiscal decision of the organization, have layers of disclosure on what's called Form 700, which is the statement of economic interests, which we'll talk about here in a second, that you disclose this information publicly so that members of the public can monitor whether or not your agency decisions are impacting your own financial interests. It's intended to be a disinfectant, you know, providing some layer of transparency into the organization's financial connections. You must file your annual statement of economic interest or Form 700s anytime you take office. So if we, I understand we've got some new board members coming on. So within 30 days of appointment to the office, they would be filling out the Form 700. You fill that out once annually in April, and it's a look back form. So you're disclosing ownership interest leading up to that point in April. And interestingly, if you're leaving office, you have an obligation to fill out a form within 30 days of leaving office. You wouldn't think that the Attorney General or the county or the FPPC monitors this, but they do. They occasionally audit this. And if you have failed to file your forms timely, which I don't think is an issue because I know Angela and others in your organization, I'm on one of your disclosure lists because I tend to be with the board and maybe could influence the decision in which I have a financial interest. So I file a Form 700 on behalf of your organization, and I get annual reminders of when to file and to electronically file, which is terrific. So, but you can be fined, I think it was $100 a month or whatnot if you're not filing annually. The bigger problem, if you're not filing, is that your agency will choose to claim that you are violating the conflicts of interest law by not filing, which technically you are, but it sounds a lot worse than it is. What needs to be disclosed? The form itself and all the instructions look complicated, and they are if you own a lot of things or own property and own companies and own businesses in the area. If you are a person more like myself, you own a home, you might have a retirement program and your business, a source of income, they're actually not that complicated. Mary, I see that you unmuted. Did you have a question?
Yes, I just wanted to add, our two new board members do not take office until January, as I recall. So they aren't required yet to do any of this, right? Until they assume their office in January. I think we sent them the invitation to this training as a courtesy to see if they were available. But technically, they don't come on board until January 1st. Angela, is that correct, Lynn? Yes.
And we're recording, so we're happy to send them the recording if they want to watch it in their downtime. But sure. Yes, within 30 days of once the appointment is official. So if the board were to take action, say, in December, but they wouldn't actually be seated until January, it'd be 30 days from the time they took action in December.
Well, no, we took action, and they were accepted as board members with a term beginning in January.
Oh, then we should go ahead and notify them to file now. It's one of those wobblers, but I would just say go ahead and if they can, get it done before they show up at the first meeting.
Why, if they're not officially on the board, they still need to be oriented by the chair and myself. I mean, there's a process here.
Let me put it this way: if they're not involved in any way, shape, or form, or have any authority yet,
that's right.
Then I think you can safely say 30 days from the day they are given that authority. And if the resolution or what it was that's passed said, your board seat shall start January 1, and the first meeting is January 14th or whatnot, I would start the day from January 1.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Sorry if I was, thank you for the clarification. So what needs to be disclosed? So if you have a business entity, if you own a business entity of $2,000 or more, for myself, obviously, I'm self-employed, my own company, I disclose the business. If you are an employee of one company, but you own another company, so you've got a paper production company or your spouse has a business in town, that could be involved in work with the school. Those are investments and businesses that need to be disclosed. If you own real property and $2,000 or more, which I always think is funny because, is there really any real property in the state of California that could be under $2,000? So if you own real property, in a moment though, you'll see if the real property is outside. So for example, if you own a home in Hawaii, if you're fortunate enough to do that, or Aspen or something like that, it's not something you need to disclose. It's only investments in real property in the area that could be impacted by the work. So most, you know, most likely anything south of Bakersfield to San Diego. You have to report any income you're receiving, $500 or more from any source, any business position. So if you're an officer, even if it's uncompensated, of one or more businesses or entities, you'd have to report that. And then you have to report gifts of $50 or more throughout the year. It's probably just a better idea for the most part not to personally accept gifts, as we'll talk about, unless they are reciprocal gifts from, you know, family, friends, and that sort of thing. So you've all seen this. Well, some of you have probably most likely seen this form. This is the cover sheet. Again, it's broadly interpreted for board members, but you don't have to report your own residence unless it's within, I would say, the 2-mile radius of the school or a school facility. And, you know, we had recently in Northern California, I had a client who lived right next door to one of the schools, and that would be a residence they would have to disclose. And the idea there was that certain actions can occur on the school site, and here, putting up light standards was but something potentially you might be fiscally interested in as to whether or not it happens. You don't have to report income from a public agency. So if you're a city or county employee, that's public agency resources, don't have to report that. You do have to report half your spouse's income. And again, financial interests within your jurisdiction. So property within 2 miles, businesses within the jurisdiction. So again, if you, this is a tough call. If you own a business that's located in Colorado Springs, but does business throughout California and does business online, per se, and that your charter schools might, say it's paper products or something like that, might do business with, it's still something that you would disclose. And gifts from all sources, inside or outside of the jurisdiction of your charter school. Jurisdiction of a charter school is kind of tricky because, you know, you can, for non-classroom-based schools, you have more limited geographic restrictions of where you can actually enroll students. Or classroom-based charter schools, which you're not, it is extremely tricky because anybody in the state of California can enroll in your school, doesn't matter where they live, but you have a little more defined boundaries of all the counties in which you serve. All right, general rule, gifts, again, my if you can avoid accepting gifts, it's probably best at the end of the day, you individually, personally. The general rule is you can't accept gifts of more than $500 in any one calendar year. You have to report gifts of $50 or more, but there's a lot of exceptions, special occasions, birthdays, as long as it's someone that you're engaging in a reciprocal gift giving, you know, gifts between Lynn and Mary, gifts between Mary and somebody else, as long as it's just someone that, you know, annually they're exchanging birthday gifts and that sort of thing. Inheritance is excluded. Family members are excluded. I love that they, you know, they have sort of a BFFs exception in the law as well. You can accept gifts. The main thing they're looking for here, honestly, is gifts from businesses and lobbyists that are trying to influence your financial decisions. That's really what they're looking for here. If you do get a gift and you don't want to keep it, you can give it away and avoid having to report it. If it's more than $500, you can give away the value of it down to $499, things like that. But again, best rule of thumb is not to do it. So those are all the financial conflicts of interest. There are two other conflicts of interest to be aware of. One is the general, what we call common law conflict of interest, and it's case law, it's not in the statutes. And what the courts have said is there are a lot of instances for public agency decision-making where the impartiality of the person could be called into question. Obviously, if you had your own child in the school, you should not be voting on whether or not to expel that student if it were coming before the board. Cannot be truly impartial, one would say, or hope, in that type of decision-making. So there are those situations where something might become before you as a board member or an officer, if there were a spouse or a sister or a brother employed in the organization and you were responsible for somehow making a decision associated with that person, the conflicts of interest law, the common law conflicts of interest law says you should not be involved in that decision. And then lastly, and this only usually comes up for board members, there is a doctrine of incompatible offices. It means, this is probably a term that's not PC anymore. It's intended to say you can't serve two, you can't serve two masters. I know that's it. You can't serve two bosses. You can't be loyal to two organizations that have conflicting and overlapping geography. So we have sometimes where a city board member or a county board member will come along and say, I want to be a board member of a charter school. And while a county supervisor and or a city board member, a city council member may not have direct oversight of a charter school, they sometimes get involved in land use planning issues. And the attorney general has opined generally that those are incompatible offices. You can't serve on both those organizations. So just something to be aware of. Other nonprofit service is fine. It's usually some form of public agency service in the same state that causes the issue. Now I am going to turn it over to Kayla to talk about the new landscape created by changes in the law recently that affect the creation and renewal of charter schools in the state.
Thanks, Paul. Good afternoon, everyone. Charter renewals. It's been a long time since schools have been thinking about this, since there was this 2-year extension on charter terms, a long hiatus, and there's new rules. We're living under this new renewal requirements thanks to Assembly Bill 1505. This was kind of an interesting situation. We were all ramping up to start this process under this new law, and then the school has got this 2-year extension. But we did live under AB 1505 for 1 year, and it was the height of the COVID year, 2020-2021. And we were out there getting renewals approved, which helped give us, and then everyone got this extension, but it helped give us some context to what we might see in AB 1505, and we can add some color on what we'll discuss today. We're going to go through 5 different sections, as you'll see here. We're going to talk about the submission process, renewal criteria, charter elements, approval denial standards, and charter appeals. And AB 1505 changed every single one of these in some fashion. So let's go on to that first section. If you could just click, Paul, it'd be great if all, next slide. Here, this is just anticipating, this is before we even get into section one, we want to make sure that we're anticipating any challenges that may arise at renewal. So think about finances, think about governance, think about special ed, EL programs, previous complaints. Those are just being ahead of the game and thinking about what might arise in the renewal cycle. And then if we click again, there should be more on this one. Yeah. We're also recommending that we start the renewal process earlier than we did before. If you have a charter, for instance, that expires June 30th, 2024, we're recommending that you submit in the summer of 23. It preserves your appeal options. Just the way the timeline works, it would allow you to get to the May state board meeting if you did have to go through appeal. So we're saying the earlier, the better, start early. Look out, of course, as always, for possible landmines. Think about what your authorizer has been requesting throughout the year. It might be something that they bring up at renewal. And then, this last one be helpful to the authorizer. Just maintain those relationships, establish those relationships to the best that you can so that they can potentially work with you as opposed to against you. Again, I know that this is something that you all do very well, knowing your audience, leveraging relationships, shoring up support. So maintaining connections with district and county staff, maintaining connections with board members, reaching out to your community members. I know that your school community really appreciates all that you do for them. And so I know that you all already do this. You have those relationships. And then use the public hearing and decision-making at the time for parents and students to show up and to show their support for the school. I know that that can be a really powerful measure for district and county boards to hear from parents, hear from students, hear how the charter school has changed the course of their child's education. That can be meaningful and moving. All right, let's get into section one. First section, charter submission. Some of the changes in AB 1505 center around just this actual process of submitting the renewal petition itself. This is one of the areas that we actually got a couple of pretty big wins. We now have a very clear timeline. So for the first time ever, we have a clear, concrete understanding of when the clock starts ticking. And this is really quite a departure from what we lived under before, where there were no clear rules. Now we have standardized measures. So what you do is the charter is now deemed received by the board on the day that it's submitted, along with this certification of completion. This starts the clock. There are then 60 days for public hearing and 90 days until decision. So we know day one starts with that certification of completeness and the charter being received. There can be 30 days of extension for mutual agreement, but absent that, it would be 90 days from that day to decision. Another huge win in this, let's see, fourth bullet point here. The district now has to make public staff recommendations, including recommended findings, and they have to give us those 15 days before the decision meeting. And this is big. Previously, most districts and counties would not really give us anything ahead of time. So we would only get the materials when they had to post them in accordance with the Brown Act, which effectively was 72 hours before the decision meeting.
And even then, if they didn't give it to their board until the meeting, they could sandbag you. We've walked into meetings and they have 90 pages of findings and they're handing it. Sure, they've given it to the board right then, and you got to, you know, respond within 15 minutes.
Absolutely. Whereas now we have this luxurious 2 weeks. So it allows the schools and us to work together, come up with this comprehensive response. The decision meeting is a public hearing. And during the decision meeting, this last bullet point, we are supposed to get equivalent time and procedures to present evidence and testimony and respond to the staff recommendations and findings. We'll see how that works out in practice. I'll talk a little further when I'm talking about charter appeals about this, but this change in law is supposed to afford more due process rights. The idea is to kind of avoid the situation we had so often where we would do our presentation and then the district or county staff would go and they would talk for three times longer than we did. And then all sorts of new questions, new details would be requested. Hopefully that is a thing of the past. We have gotten some indication through that 1 year before the extension of what this equivalent time and procedures will look like from school districts and counties. And the report is that many authorizers have been respectful of this equivalent time. So they'll say something like, you can have as much time as we took, or you can have 10 minutes, whichever is greater. I will say that it can cut both ways. One time under these new rules, Janelle Rooley, the partner at our firm who predominantly handles renewals, threw that a district board meeting and the chartering authority's lawyer spoke for 2 minutes and 45 seconds. And then we were expected to only speak for 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So, you know, that was really challenging, give and take. But on the whole, if the authorizer does follow the law and does uphold equivalent time and procedures, it's very much going to be to our benefit.
And I think it's going to be important to video record the meetings, make sure we keep an accurate record of the meetings if we think it's going to be controversial.
Absolutely. All right, just like that, we're on section two, charter renewal criteria. So most charter schools under AB 1505 are now sorted into these three categories. They were given high, middle, and low performing categories. And the CDE published a list dictating what school was in what category. And there were a lot of changes based on what category you were in. However, that does not apply to DOS schools. For DOS schools, it's a completely different thing. We don't have the high, middle, low distinction. Instead, what we have is that the chartering authority will consider, in addition to the school's performance on the dashboard is still going to matter, but they'll consider this alternative metrics based on the specific pupil population served. And what we'll see, I'll talk about this a little bit more in the next slide, actually, what that alternative metrics might look like. If you're a DOS school, which all of Adeo Corp's schools are, you don't have to worry about the high, middle, low, like I said. Instead, what you do is you have a meeting with the chartering authority and you talk to them and you mutually agree on what these alternative metrics that we should be using when it comes to renewal. So you meet, mutually agree and discuss. And then after that meeting, the chartering authority is supposed to send you a letter and say, okay, here are the metrics that we're going to use. This has happened in a lot of different ways in real life. Sometimes the school district is willing to let the charter take the lead. Obviously on the charter side, we find that to be the best. Sometimes school districts and county offices are really engaged and they do take the law to what I'll say is it's maybe plain meaning. They'll hold the meeting, they'll talk to the charter school, and then they'll decide what those alternative metrics are. One thing we don't want to have happen, just in terms of thinking about timing here, is we don't want it to be summer 2023, your charter's up in 2024, and nobody's had a conversation. So we suggest reaching out, sending an email, have that conversation early, so that come renewal, when you're getting everything ready, you're fully prepared on what those alternative metrics are going to be. Next slide. Oh yeah, actually this is great. This is also different for DOS schools. It's different from the high, middle, low, who have just a total range of reasons that can be denied. The law now says that a chartering authority may deny a DOS school if it makes a finding that closure is in the best interest of students. And I find that to be a really difficult finding to make, closure in the best interest of students, that a DOS school would be denied for that would be surprising. And so it's a pretty high bar. And then strangely, one thing that's just sort of weird, unlike the non-DOS schools, who they're categorized, you know, into this high, middle, low, and then if approved, they receive a charter term based on that categorization. The law does not say anything about the length of the term for a DOS school. So is it 5 years? Is it 7 years? Is it 20 years? You know, it doesn't say. So it's just interesting that they left that off.
What about a non-classroom based school?
It's the same. I mean, whether you're DOS or not DOS, that's how it's done. But they didn't make any distinction in the law for non-classroom-based versus classroom-based charters.
So our schools are available to be 7 years approved schools?
It doesn't say, right? I mean, if you're all your schools are DOS schools, for the high-performing schools that aren't DOS schools, they get a seven-year term potentially. And for DOS schools, it doesn't actually give that requirement. So we're going to have to see how that bears out. But it's an interesting vagueness or hole in the law.
But it sounds like one, and I haven't studied this with Janelle, it sounds like one that we should be articulating an argument for the longer term.
Absolutely.
Let the granting agency push back and say they have some level of discretion in there, but we can argue there isn't.
Absolutely.
Well, if the standard of achievement for the schools is way beyond the county or state's outcomes, I would think that they'd be eligible for a seven-year approval.
Me too. I mean, it's certainly the argument to make.
Can the local district develop policy that identifies a certain type of school that isn't eligible for 7 years?
You mean a DOS school? So for the high, middle, low, they may have to clear. So the non-classroom versus classroom doesn't matter under these renewal standards. What matters is the DOS versus non-DOS. So for the non-DOS schools, it's very clear in the law. If you're low, you're eligible for X. If you're middle, you're eligible for X. If you're high, you're eligible for X, right? Whereas the non-DOS schools, they just left its opening. So I think what Paul said, what we'll want to do is we'll want to set forth an argument that we should be entitled to 7 years because of the high performance.
We did actually push on this a bit with San Diego Unified and the CDE, and they, the CDE, I can't remember the lady's name, but one of the bigger higher ups came out and said, well, our guidance is it's 5 years for DOS. And they kind of, I don't know if they put it in the frequently asked questions section of the CDE website or they came out with a presentation and said it. So it kind of shot it down at the time, but it didn't, you're right, the law is vague. So there's definitely a case there, but we did make an attempt when this first came out towards advocating for 7.
Yeah, okay.
Team, even with San Diego Unified School District, we tried that when we were working on the criteria.
And they we actually wrote it into the criteria at first, and then they changed it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I mean, the law is not clear, and the CDE can't just come in and fill in that hole, but... All right, let's talk about charter elements. The changes, there have been changes here.
Excuse me. No, we can deal with the CDE. It's the local policy. And I would just propose it would be helpful in your dialogue with CCSA, which we'll do the same, to engage their support in helping clarify that there is no law against any particular mode of delivery having a 5-year max, that a 7-year is available to them. I mean, we want to push that. So anything that your firm can do to help us bring that forward now would be really great.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll review the legislative history too, Mary, to see if we can build that argument, which I hope we can, that the legislature didn't intend to be eliminated for the DOS schools.
Yeah, like when you present, I know that there's district people there when you present at the conferences. And so if in fact your research supports that, that's a good place to start, I think.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, charter elements. There's also changes in this world. As you'll see here, the law requires a reasonably comprehensive description of any new requirement of charter schools enacted into law after the charter was originally granted or last renewed. So this is going to be any changes in the law that have happened since your last renewal, and there have been a lot. I'll go over a couple of these just quickly. The first is the element 7 changed. If you recall, it used to be that the school had to show how it was going to have a racial and ethnic balance of the pupils that was representative of the balance in the school district. That still exists, but they expanded it out. In addition to this racial and ethnic balance, they now include special education pupils and English learners need to be reflective of the general population residing within what they call the territorial jurisdiction of the school district. Another new requirement on the next slide, somewhat awkwardly phrased, the names and relevant qualifications of all persons whom the petition nominates to serve on the governing board body of the charter school. This is just the names and qualifications of your board members. So you'll want to include that in your renewal petition. And then throughout the charter, there's been a myriad of different
changes. Is that a general qualifications that would apply to all members? Or is it individual as you give the names, you give their specific skill set I see Jim Hurst is a businessman with excellent background in, you know, organizational theory and stuff. Exactly. And Wayland, you know, he's great on PR, social media, you know, how to expand and develop businesses in that way. I mean, they all have their unique thing, but there's also more global general criteria. So which is the way we go?
The specificity, a little bio for each of them, how they, you know, what they've done, what their accomplishments are. And that, you know, it doesn't need to be extraordinarily long. It shouldn't be.
But yeah. No, I get it. It's about three sentences that say they're a business person and they bring financial expertise or that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Well, recall that, you know, the standard overlaying it is reasonably comprehensive, right? You know, the reasonably comprehensive description. So we got to make sure that your granting agency perceives it as a reasonably comprehensive description of the bio, of the qualifications.
Mm-hmm. That's easy to do. Laura has an expertise in leases and, you know, acquisitions and all that stuff. And so does Greg. Yeah, they all have their own thing that we can actually write about.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm good at building haunted houses too. So add that.
That's timely right now. I want to
hear more about that. Yeah.
Glad to send your recording.
Yeah.
Throughout the law, there's been a myriad of changes, including governing law affirmation. We also have health and safety, admission, suspension, and expulsion. The Assembly Ed Committee has been applying just tons of their new laws to both school districts and explicitly also to charter schools. So they're continually adding new laws and requirements. Health and safety, admission, suspension, and expulsion usually do, though, change year to year. So it's not terribly surprising. Charter schools are, as you may know, not required to comply with the suspension and expulsion laws that apply to traditional school districts. However, many do follow that list of enumerated offenses, which just changes all the time. And so these are just changes to be mindful of. Of course, you know, we can chat about what all of those are and the details of all of them as renewal comes up. All right, section 4, approval and denial standards. Standard for approval. So usually when schools think about submitting their charter, one of the first things that comes to mind is the denial standards, right? Like, what is the district or county going to try to do to deny it? But on the other side of the coin, there are these approval standards. And so I want to underscore that under AB 1505, the statute really did maintain that legislative intent that's really in our favor. The legislative intent that says that a governing board shall grant a charter. So the default is to approve, shall grant a charter for the operation of the school if it's satisfied that granting the charter is consistent with the sound educational practice. And then this part you'll see here in red is new, if it's also consistent with the interests of the community in which the school is proposing to locate. There we go. And then, of course, the governing board shall consider the academic needs. And then renewals of charters are governed by the same standards and criteria that we had to follow for charter approval in the first place. So that hasn't changed. For DOS schools, as we've discussed, the charter is reviewed in accordance with this alternative metrics. And the charter may be denied with written findings, like I said earlier, that the closure of the charter school is in the best interest of the students. Again, I just find that to be a really high bar for them to meet. So I think that that's a win. Okay, charter appeals. A couple notes on this. The appeals process has changed dramatically and not necessarily in the charter school's favor. However, if you hear nothing from me in this section, hear that if you are currently authorized by the district, you do still have full de novo rights, a clean slate at the county level. So if the district is your authorizer and they deny it, you can appeal to the county and it's a totally de novo review. But it used to also be that we had a de novo review, this kind of clean slate at the state board level. And that tended to be a pretty good safety net, I'd say, most of the time for these overzealous districts and counties that were denying. Unfortunately, they have now changed that. So now the State Board of Education will only do a review if there is an abuse of discretion, which is an undefined term of art, which is unfortunate for reasons I'll talk about, and an incredibly high bar to meet. So we no longer should be counting on the state as the safety net that it once was. Timeline, we have 30 days to appeal a denied charter and a denied renewal, denied establishment and denied renewal. And then there's 180 days for judicial review if the county or state board fail to act. I wanna just underscore that 30 days to get that appeal submitted. It's a really quick turnaround.
De novo review, does that mean that it's, they have to take a new look at it, but is it the same petition that you presented to the district still?
Yes, it's, and we'll talk about that just on our very next slide. We have the county appeals. So we'll talk about that, but yes, it's a clean slate.
I will say on the as Kayla said, the State Board of Education reviewing only if there's an abuse of discretion. There's been three AB 1505 appeals thus far to the State Board of Education. They denied two and approved one. They should have probably approved two. Clearly there was an abuse of discretion in one of the others that's being looked at a little further by our office as to whether or not there might be some subsequent challenge. But so whereas, I don't know what the overall track record was, but the state board probably was above 50% approval of charter appeals, maybe as high as 60 or 70% in some areas. We might be down as low as 30%-ish going forward. So it's not, the door's not closed, but of course politics changes daily with the state board, so.
What kind of abuse did they approve of?
I was gonna chat about them if we want. I have a few things I was gonna say about them when we get to that, but you can talk about it now, Paul.
No, go ahead. If there's a slide coming up, I forgot the order of the slides. I thought maybe one abuse slide, yeah.
Okay. Charter appeal to the county. So right now we're just at the county level. It's this de novo review. One new requirement is that you have to submit the petition to the county board, the appeal petition. You have to submit it at the same time to the school district when you submit it to the county. Obviously, if you're doing it electronically, that's easy. You just send them both out. If you're hand delivering it, it's a little harder, but I think that that'll just be a reasonable standard. You know, you can't be in two places at once. The County Board of Education then reviews pursuant to the same section 47605. And it largely still, it's the de novo review. And they are reviewing, like Mary mentioned, they are reviewing the same charter that the district denied. So there's no changes there. Okay, let's see here.
Does your first bullet refer to the initial application to the district? The first one, do you send a copy or do you only send a copy to the county if you are appealing?
It's only on appeal. So we're talking about the appeal petition. When you're sending in your appeal, you have to send it both to the county and to the district at the same time.
And is there further county appeal slides? Because I know you, I focused on the slides I was presenting on. Not as
so well. Interesting. Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to say anything more about
that? Well, the provision that says if there's material changes, how they can keep bouncing it back.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to be an interesting thing. They can, if there are material changes to that charter, they can keep bouncing it back actually to the district, which is just
for a redo, which is for reconsideration, which is really interesting. You could purposely change it to force a redo by the school district. It's just kind of a weird provision in the law that before you would sometimes, if you appealed early, let's say your charter term was going to expire and, you know, a year and a half from now, you appealed early and it was denied. Sometimes we would argue that you could go back and make the revisions to address the staff report and resubmit the renewal. And some school districts allowed it. Others said, no, it's a one-shot thing. You got one time to go for a renewal. Well, now you could appeal to the county, make changes to address this, the school district's finding, and the county should send it back to the district because of the material revisions. So it's kind of interesting. I think that's a little bit of a win, although again, and that's all the more reason to emphasize what Kayla was saying, you've got to start really early in this process because of the extended timelines, the potential for bouncing back and forth to go forward.
Yeah, and the same is in this last bullet here, the same is true at the state board level too. If there are new or different terms, the state board immediately remands back for reconsideration, which then has to occur within 30 days. So it's just kind of a weird, but maybe a win sort of thing. So we've already talked about the fact that it's harder to get to the state board now. The charter school needs to, if you are appealing to the state board, the charter school needs to submit findings and documents from both the district and the county. So it's like a full documentary record. The district and county need to prepare that record, something I'll talk about when I talk about the three appeals, including transcripts, no later than 10 business days. So they don't have a very long turnaround. We then have to look at that record, cite specific places in the record where they went wrong. And at this point, you need to submit, if you're appealing to the state, you have to submit that appeal to both the district and the county and the state. And then, as I said in this last bullet point, if you include new or different material, it remands back. All right. The district and county at the appeal level to the state now have a formal right to submit opposition within 30 days. And they almost always took it upon themselves to do this anyway, but that just codifies their right. Next bullet point there. Okay, the ACCS. So the actual mechanism for this SBE appeal process, the ACCS holds a public hearing to review the appeal and the record, and then they make a recommendation to the state board whether there's sufficient evidence to hear the appeal. So it means that the state board is not even necessarily going to hear it. They can accept ACCS's recommendation not to and just summarily deny it. Next slide. If the state board does hear it, it's under an abuse of discretion standard, which again is a high standard, hard to overturn. And then if the SB also does hear it, this is just an important point. If they hear it, if they reverse, they will then designate either the district or the county as the authorizer. They are out of the business of being charter school authorizers, so they'll designate either one of those. And then I, Paul, feel free to add additional context on these. I just talked with Janelle. We actually don't have slides on these, but I talked with Janelle about the three various appeals just to add some additional context. So as Paul said, there's been three different appeals that have gone through the state board meetings under this new standard now. One in the July meeting and then two just in the September meeting. And as Paul mentioned, the overall track record on those is 1 out of 3 was approved by the state board. And when I say approved, that means they overturned the denial at the district or county level. In the first appeal, what was frustrating was a lot of the procedural requirements that we talked about earlier, that the equivalent time and procedures, their requirement that they prepare a transcript, a lot of those procedural requirements were violated. And so that's what the appeal was based in part on, the violation of those new requirements for maybe 1505. And what was unfortunately demonstrated by the Department of Education and the State Board of Education is that a violation of those requirements alone is not really enough to convince them to overturn a denial. They are apparently, although the law makes no mention of this, and explicitly requires the things that I just mentioned, they're apparently looking for some sort of nexus between the harm that was done and the denial. So for example, if the district takes 30 minutes to present and the charter school only gets 10, we have to somehow show a direct harm there. And you would think that it would be obvious that we only got one third of the time to be able to make our case. And yet they didn't seem to grasp that. The second appeal involved a charter that was submitted to a district that is still in technical terms in state receivership. So it has about 2 years left to pay down its loan. It's on track to pay down that loan. It has millions and millions of dollars in reserves. But what the law says in that case is that there's this rebuttable presumption of denial of the charter, which the charter school can overcome by showing that the district is actually positioned to be able to absorb any fiscal impact. What was difficult about that one, though, is that the state board decided not even to hear the merits of it. There was no hearing. They decided to summarily deny, not actually hear it, basically because of the receivership, basically ignoring the evidence presented that the district could absorb it. They had these millions and millions in reserves. So that was another challenging one. The one charter that was approved, it was a situation of a brand new school, a startup school, submitted to the district. The district had a lot of bad procedures, like egregiously bad. And the county also didn't follow all of the procedures. And somehow the state of Board of Education decided that one, that was enough from the others and decided to approve it. So as Paul said, you know, 1 to 3 is not the track record that any of us had before the pandemic. And I don't think, and Paul, correct me, I don't think that there's any more on the horizon, not right now, not because the renewal cycle, I guess, won't be starting until next summer or fall. But so I don't know that we'll have until that time, but it's difficult to kind of pull out jurisprudence from these three. But just to add
some concern as we're looking at the way the state board was advised by the California Department of Education about their interpretation of what an abuse of discretion is and what must occur if they do find an abuse of discretion. And so there's also an argument that the Department of Ed was establishing rules, its own procedural rules around this that are not part, they had normally rules that apply to agencies have to go through the Administrative Procedure Act. You know, they have to be reviewed, vetted, commented on, and approved by the State Board of Education. So there's also some concern the CDE and State Board are adopting rules without following the normal protocol. There's going to be some fighting here because the State Board is somewhat sympathetic, although the politics of State Board has changed. The California Department of Education, however, is generally not. Politics there are generally not in favor of charter schools. So we're going to see, I think, recommendations from CDE that are to deny. And you know, you're going to have to really win the politics behind the day of the state board members to be able to count on, or at least be able to consider counting on the state board voting for a renewal.
All right, we're going to leave renewal land and go into revocation. I'm going to go through these slides really quickly. If you have, just because we have a lot of content to cover in the next 55 minutes, and I want to be conscious of everyone's time. But if you need to refer back to these, certainly do. We've laid out all of the revocation there. The main point that I want to make with revocation is that a chartering authority can only revoke after providing due process and specified procedures that are articulated in the education code and the regulations. So, you know, as it says here, in the absence of a severe and imminent threat, a chartering authority can only revoke for these four reasons, making a specific, they have to have a written finding, they have to be supported by substantial evidence that the charter has committed a material violation or failed to meet or pursue the pupil outcomes, 3, financial issues, fiscal mismanagement, or 4, a violation of the law. Those are the only 4 that they can do. And even before that, even to revoke on any one of these, there's a lot of steps that they need to take beforehand. So before revocation, they have to first take action and deliver this notice of violation. There are certain requirements that the notice of violation has to include. There has to obviously explain that alleged violation, as well as all evidence that they have of that. The notice also must show that the violation is material. They're not just bringing up something small and de minimis to be obnoxious and uncured. They also have to do it within a reasonable time period before that the notice of violation was issued. And then they have to importantly give the charter school a reasonable time to remedy and refute those violations. So there's this substantial remedy period. We'll go to the next one.
This has to be done in a public meeting.
Right. Yep. Yeah. At least 72 hours prior to any meeting, the chartering authority in which they're going to consider this notice of violation, they have to provide you with the notice and all the relevant materials that are part of that proposed action. Like I said, the charter school then has the opportunity to respond and submit a detailed response, refutations, the remedial action that's been taken, the proposed remedial action that will be taken in the future. And the chartering authority then takes a look at those and they evaluate their response and they either decide to forego the notice period. They decide to discontinue revocation, or they continue the revocation by taking the next step, which again has a due process procedural requirements that they have to follow. If they don't discontinue, they have to issue this notice of intent to revoke, and it has to be within 60 calendar days of the conclusion of the remedy period. So they can't just sit on it and have the time. You also have the opportunity to appeal. So if a school district is the chartering authority and it does the revocation, it follows all that, the charter school may appeal that revocation to the county board. Likewise, the county board's decision may be appealed to the SBE, to the state board, by either the charter school or the school district. So interestingly, if the county overturns, the school district can then appeal that to the state board. All right, so that was incredibly fast.
That's okay. No, you spent the time focusing on what is really the primary component of consideration here, which is the renewal for your schools. I'm not so much worried about revocation notices or notice of intent to revoke here for these schools. So let's just turn to avoiding malfeasance. As I was talking about in the conflict of interest slides, fiscal malfeasance and conflicts and other problems are one of the big issues that have led to some revocation, some non-renewals of charter schools, and frankly led to a lot of headlines we don't need in the charter school world over the years. So we're going to cover a little bit of the big picture and then talk about some of the actual operators that have gotten into trouble. But generally, what can we use public school money for? You've got this quote up here at the beginning of the first bullet, which is that, general purpose entitlement funding, which is kind of the old language from the old funding where we had general purpose and block grant language instead of the new funding. But says may be used by any public purpose determined by the governing board of the charter school. But LCFF supplemental and concentration grants and the amount that the resources you've dedicated in your LCAP plan have to be spent in accordance with that. And funds received from your charter school generally are all considered public funds. Now you can create separate accounts. You can have a foundation or whatnot, create separate accounts for private funds, which is the best way to go if you think you're going to use money on some things that we're talking about here that you can't use public money on. Some additional authority that circumscribe the use of your funds, the Nonprofit Integrity Act of 2004 has certain provisions that apply, mainly creating the obligation to have a compensation review committee review compensation of your CEO and CBO for purposes of setting salary to avoid excess salary concerns. We've got the conflict of interest laws we've talked about. And then there's also another layer of corporations code, which prevents self-dealing. Now, the self-dealing rules in the corporations code actually allow for contracts between the board members and the organization. But again, as we've talked about with the conflict of interest laws, those would prohibit it. So wouldn't want to do that. The two big areas of trip up outside conflicts in the penal code is embezzlement and misappropriation of public funds. So just so everybody's aware, embezzlement has primarily two elements. you are someone in the organization who's spending money outside the authority of your authority, and you do it with an intent to put it to use at something other than what it's lawfully intended to be. So there's an intent element in embezzlement, a little harder to prove. Misappropriation of public funds is a little more subjective and a little more troublesome, because you can be charged with misappropriation of public funds if you have some control over public funds. And the first one here is the primary one. Without the authority, you appropriate the money and use it for something other than its intended use. It's pretty vague. As you'll see, some of the people who have gotten in trouble with misappropriation of public funds have used money for, you know, trips to go see Obama's inauguration and trips to personal trips to Disneyland and things like that. You can also, if you're loaning public monies outside the authority of the organization, you can get into trouble with misappropriation. If you knowingly keep any false accounts or you fraudulently alter papers to support those false accounts, Eugene C. Leibanoff back in the day, along with the conflict of interest issues, got in trouble because some of his audits to the Los Angeles Unified School District reflected what he was doing with the property, which they later determined to be allegedly a misappropriation of public funds. But because he also put forth audit reports that reflected that, there was another count added because he had these records that were allegedly trying to conceal the actions. If you willfully withhold money that you're owed or owed over to somebody under a public account, you can also engage in misappropriation. Any violation of misappropriation is punishable by imprisonment, state prison for 2, 3, or 4 years, and you're disqualified from holding any future office, which some of these people are that we'll talk about here in future. Another area that has tripped up some charter schools is an area of law that doesn't apply to public school districts. It's one of those things that throughout the course of case law, court decisions have made an exception and said, look, charter schools are nonprofits, so they don't fall into the same bucket as school districts. And because they're nonprofits, they're more public and they're more private than public. So they apply the False Claims Act. Now, where this comes into play generally is making claims for funding, either grant funding or ADA funding of the state. So if you knowingly present a false claim, so you say you falsify ADA or attendance records, that would make you guilty of a False Claims Act, which you'll see here in a minute is bad. If you make use of a false record and make a false claim, if you conspire to commit a false claim, or you have possession of property that was from the state knowingly, that was achieved through false claims, all the way down to if you're the beneficiary of monies under a false claim and you find out it's false claim and you don't return it, you can be guilty of a false claim. But generally what these rules say is you need to be careful with the records you submit to the government that justify your funding. They have to be researched, they have to be accurate as best you can, they have to be researched and reasonable. Now, mistakes can get made. That's fine. But if it turns out you were just signing attendance reports and you never looked at the supporting documentation, or you were supporting making applications for grants from the state or federal government, and you sort of recklessly were exaggerating certain expenditures, this could come back to be a problem. If you get sued, and this is one of those areas where they have and allow what's called a bounty hunter law, a third party, a private person, can sue the school, actually ask the attorney general for the permission to sue the school under these laws. And this is what happened to, you might have, K-12 and CAVA schools. There was an incident there where someone filed, it's called a QI-TAM action. They asked for the attorney general and they make these claims because if they're successful, they get 30% of the return. That's why we call it a bounty hunter. And the return is huge because if you do violate False Claims Act, you got to pay 3 times the amount of money. So say you gained 100 grand for false ADA claims, you're going to pay 300,000 back. You have to pay the state the money they used to sue you, which is crazy. And every one of the claims that's false is up to $11,000 fine. And so, you know, every push of a button or check mark or whatnot can be considered separate. And so this can mount up to be hundreds of thousands of dollars very quickly, and it's a big problem. So additional issues to be aware of out there, you know, nonprofits can't use their money for private inurement. And what this is usually an issue where you've got related parties and you've got for-profits and nonprofits intermingled. You don't have that here, which is good. Some of the problems we'll talk about here shortly were places where a charter school tried to create, and they created another for-profit, another nonprofit. And what it looked like to the IRS was that the nonprofit in the middle, the one that was holding the charter school, was essentially just being operated for the private benefit of these other parties. That's what they're looking for. And if there's a situation where you don't do your comp studies and justify your compensation of your top executives, you can get into a situation where there's excess comp and have to pay back fees to the IRS. 30 years, we've not had such a situation in the charter school. Now, just as that, you know, these are the extremes. These are the ones, obviously, but they're examples that are public, so we can talk about them. Eugene C. Levanoff was the founder of a charter school in 2012, I think it was, in Los Angeles, a very high-performing middle school. He and his wife started the school. They used their own credit cards to start the school. They because the school couldn't get a lease from the landlord, they leased the building and subleased it back to the school. And they did a lot of things that a lot of people felt for the longest period of time were perfectly fine. They did staff appreciation nights and they bought wine. They bought gift cards for their employees. And the DA came in and said, all of that is unlawful. You can't buy gift cards. You can't buy gifts. You can't buy wine. You can't own the building and lease it to the school. And came in and Eugene C. Levanoff was prosecuted and found guilty for those, many of those charges, and spent 2.5 years, unfortunately, in prison. Jeremy Landau, this is not an unfortunate situation because this guy's just a complete thief. He was a board member of a charter school, came along with one of those things you read about in emails you think nobody would ever fall for. And he said to the school, look, if you give me $750,000 in a couple weeks' time, I'll return $3 million. I got this deal. I can convert that money into $3 million. And they unbelievably gave him $750,000. And not surprisingly, he disappeared. I think the law finally caught up with him in Spain. He's never returned the money. Was facing 14 years in prison last time we checked. I think he has since been convicted or found guilty. And but this is one of those ones where you're like, come on, really? No one's going to do that, I hope. So. Stephen Cox, however, early charter school, non-classroom-based charter school operator, Mary's and Lynn have been around, others have been around long enough to remember his name, founder of California Charter Academy. When they collapsed on themselves, they had 36 schools and tens of thousands of students, and they closed overnight. FICMAT and an audit came in and determined that there was a for-profit he had set up, and millions of dollars were going from the nonprofit to the for-profit to manage the nonprofit, and that they had paid themselves lavish salaries, taken huge groups of people to Disneyland, bought themselves spa tickets and concert tickets and everything like that. And oddly, he's still facing prosecution. It's been since 2007, and there was a city council member on his board that was also facing prosecution. And if you ever want to read something that's just the most bizarre story, he has hired and fired lawyers. He had a lawyer who died. He had a lawyer that someone attempted to murder. And every year or so, when he's about ready to face trial, something happens. And now the file for the case, I've been told, could fill two storage units. And nobody wants to take the case on for the DA anymore because it literally would take a year and a half to read all the documents to prosecute. So he's been sitting out there. I think he's moved to Arizona and retired. And these two people haven't faced prosecution yet, but there are charges still pending against him, which is unbelievable that justice hangs out there like that. Now here's more of a situation, I think, closer to home. You had the executive director of Ways Charter School, founder, who had some buildings that she owned, and she leased the buildings to the school. I think, as I recall, the lease was actually below market. She was paid $300,000 over the course of those leases, but she was involved in both parts of the negotiation, you know, like brought it to the school, negotiated for the school on behalf of herself, signed both, you know, and you ended up with a contract with the school. The FPPC fined her $16,000 in violating the conflict of interest laws that we were talking about earlier. Vilka McFarland, very successful founder and operator of a group of charter schools, grew the organization, Celerity, and again, had a bunch of nonprofits and for-profits and had family members working at different various organizations and kind of a complicated web of organizations. Was a complaint was filed against her for charges of violating misappropriation and embezzlement. Allegedly, she spent $2.5 million. This is the one where I was saying she bought a building for a charter school she was trying to open in another state. She flew first class, went to Obama's inauguration, went to Miami, you know, did a lot of stuff, bought recumbent bikes for her husband. And I think she bought clothes for herself at one point. Now, interestingly, a lot of those things are things that nonprofits, those of you who are on nonprofits, realize are done in the nonprofit world. I mean, sometimes when you look at these giant nonprofits like Red Cross and others, they spend a lot of money on things like this. But you as board members and employees of this organization have your feet in two worlds, one where it might be lawful and the other where it's prohibited. And of course, you know which law is going to be applied at the end of the day. So, you know, the thing is, stop me, Kayla, if I'm slipping into the slides that you were going to cover here.
Okay, the next two slides that we're going to cover just have, they kind of have a list of the things that we've just talked about, right? Like the things that we saw trip people up or things that just in our experience have tripped people up. These sort of things can bear on potential criminal liability, first class travel, Paul just talked about, alcohol purchases, expensive meals, hotels, entertainment, expenditures, like even a holiday party or, you know, a staff appreciation party. Travel not directly related to school purposes, gifts, and there's more on the next slide, of purchasing personal items, car leases, loans to employees, renting apartments, condos, large employee expense accounts. And I think here, you know, oh, there's even more. Golf and golf club memberships, gift cards, that was one we talked about right at the beginning. Payment of debts, payments to vendors with familial ties, and political contributions and donations. You know, you all have done a great job of, you know, you have this travel and expense reimbursement policy. You've clearly delineated what expenses are reimbursable, what expenses are not. You list out for your meals how much can be spent at that meal and will be reimbursed.
Prohibits alcohol and things like that. Along
it does, yeah. It really perfectly aligns with everything here. Transfer of funds, just kind of moving gears a little bit, between schools operated by the same nonprofit have been under attack. So it's important to note here that the state auditor is actually has said that transfers are okay. As long as certain conditions are met, they're temporary. It's not like you're constantly loaning from one to another. And there's no impact to the educational program. And the expenditures of the loaning school are board approved. So in that case, the state auditor has said it's okay, despite this attack from some authorizers. FICMAT is actually even more supportive of transfers than the state auditor, at least for independent study schools, but of course, you know, be careful, take the measures that you need to take in order to do it. Transfers of funds and intellectual property from schools to CMO organizations, charter management organizations, I would say to and from, are also under attack by some authorizers.
But this is where you take intellectual property and not just share it with another one of your nonprofit colleagues that you're operating the same schools with, as much as you're gifting it to another nonprofit so they can go to another state, for example, and, you know, use that intellectual property. You can sell it, but giving it away to another nonprofit that operates charter schools without reimbursement is an issue.
Yeah. We recommend, as we have here, consulting with legal counsel before transferring funds to other schools, not using charter funds for purposes other than operating a California public charter school. That's another thing that can be under scrutiny. And if you are going to develop an out-of-state school, to use funds that are segregated, so that just your authorizer can't attack on those grounds.
But none of this is a problem if it's schools that are in the same county, or do they have to be like schools that are under the same authorizer? Or
yeah, I mean,
no, you're okay as long as it's same schools within the same nonprofit. So your six schools.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it used to matter keep record keeping. Like if you're gonna, a lot of this is also when you're growing and you've got, you know, a charter school. A nonprofit starts charter school one, and they use some of the money from one to start two, and they use, you know, money from two to start three, and then keeping track of it and repaying, and that's all fine.
And the next two slides cover developing appropriate safeguards, many of which, again, you already have in place. You have checks and balances. You know, we also recommend reconciliation reports be issued, reviewed, approved by management. Not allowing school credit cards. If you do have school credit cards, very strictly controlling them. Board of directors oversight, especially of that of executive director principal expenses. I don't think you all have a concern there. And fiscal policies and procedures. Again, something that you all have developed. Limits on use of school assets, using them for the educational purpose, serving that school. Strict controls on petty cash. Other CAF, you know, CAF is not as, it's not documented as well. And then doing what you can to protect checks against fraudulent use. Same sort of thing in number nine, just having these solid internal controls. And then 10, something that we've talked about a number of times today, just avoiding these related party transactions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over. I know we're covering a lot today. Paul is now going to delve into our next topic.
So you're a nonprofit public benefit corporation, and there's certain things you need to do to maintain and certain things you need to do to avoid to maintain your nonprofit status. The education code from very early on, 1998, I believe it was added, allows charter schools to operate as or by nonprofit public benefit corporations, which was actually something school districts wanted to see, because in the law, it allows them to be insulated from the debts and liabilities of the charter school if they are operated as a nonprofit. And as a result, in 30 years, there has not been a case where a charter school that has collapsed for financial reasons has had a liability backwash onto its granting agency. The charter school itself, there have been a number of charter schools that have gone through bankruptcy, or corporate dissolution, or an assignment for benefit of creditors. And in all those cases, school districts have been protected, which is great. The law allows for the school district representative, your authorizing agency to put a representative on your board, not something they are doing right now for you and your organizations, but it is something that can come along sometime in the future. There's a few school districts in the state that are doing that, but not many, because where school districts have exercised that right, for example, years ago in Orange County, there was a middle school there, a conversion middle school. The district had two board members on that charter school. And when the charter school got sued for a sexual molestation case by a teacher, where that board had voted to return that teacher and ignored the warning signs about that teacher, the school district itself also got sued in that $20 million lawsuit. Now, as it was, the charter school settled that lawsuit through its insurance again, and the agency wasn't liable, but districts technically don't want to have that connection to the way that you operate your organization. So the nonprofit provides both a shell and liability protection for a granting agency. And for you all as volunteer board members, you have the highest level of governmental immunity allowed in the law for you being volunteer board members of a nonprofit public benefit corporation. So you're tax exempt, you're a nonprofit public benefit corporation, but you're also tax exempt under 501c3. There's a bunch of designations you can be tax exempt under, but you qualify as a public school, but under the IRS. So if you looked at your letter of determination from the IRS, they would say you're a 509A1 organization, a school. So there's a couple of things you can do that can jeopardize that tax-exempt status. You want to maintain your tax-exempt status primarily because people can make donations and loan, and you can have tax-exempt financing for loans and bonds, et cetera. So you don't want to jeopardize your tax-exempt status. You can't engage in five main things. You can't have private inurement. Again, you can't be operated for the benefit of some private third party. There is a limited lobbying I'll talk about. You cannot have political campaign activity. I'll explain it in a couple slides. If you engage in an activity that's outside your charitable purpose, say you decide that you're going to create a car wash to generate some excess cash or whatnot, you can do that. But that if it is more than a substantial amount of money, and it's usually about 10% of your overall revenue, you're going to start paying what they call unrelated business income tax on that revenue. And you can fail to comply by not filing your annual Form 990s, which are your annual statements of revenue expenditures. And if you don't do that 3 years in a row, you can actually suspend your tax exempt status. So just kind of going through those in order. Charter school, nonprofits have to be operated for charitable purpose and can't be operated for public private benefit. And the IRS, like I said earlier, is looking for connections to your nonprofit where there might be some sort of controlling interest and money outflowing to a private, not, it can be another nonprofit, in fact, or but most likely it's obviously usually like for profits. And then if you do the compensation committee issue, you're establishing reasonable rebuttable presumption around your salaries setting, which is an area where private inurement comes up. So lobbying. A nonprofit can engage in some lobbying designed to influence legislation, but it can't be more than a substantial amount. It's really hard to define. It's very vague in the law. So we don't recommend that charter schools do a lot of lobbying or spend a lot of money on lobbying, but they can do some lobbying. What they can't do is they can't engage in political campaign and activity. So you cannot use public funds of the tax exempt or funds of the nonprofit, I should say, which are also public funds, to directly or indirectly influence a campaign or a ballot measure. So that's just a flat prohibition. Whereas you can do some limited lobbying, just can't argue against, argue for candidates for office or ballot measures. And I know because your administration has checked with us on occasion, can I forward this? Can we post this? Because there's a sensitivity to making sure that you're not crossing the line here. So your organization has not, does this well. I know Lynn's probably primarily responsible for making sure you calendar and do this each year, but you've got to file your 199s with the state and your 990s with the feds. And what happens with a lot of charter schools is they get up and they get running and they get eager to start educating kids, and they forget about some of these operational things, and they think their accountant is doing it. And next thing you know, they didn't see the email or the letter that says you failed to file. And in the third year, all of a sudden your tax exempt status is revoked and your nonprofit is revoked as well. Now there's a reinstatement process that you can go through, but it's costly and you have to pay us to fix it. And it's kind of a mess. So, but again, you're not doing anything there that I'm concerned about. That's a worry there. So let's just turn quickly to, since I think we have about 25 minutes left here, to talk a little bit about where the cases and the law and things are changing for you. You might recall that there was, during the pandemic, and during the budget bill and the budget cycle, ISB 820 and the budget bill 98, that said to non-classroom-based charter schools for the 2021 school year, you are not going to be funded on anything higher than your ADA and P2 from the prior year. We don't care how many more kids you enrolled. And this happened, the purposes of notifying the charter schools that they were not going to be funded for that growth was well after most of the charter schools had already enrolled, by operation of the law and by operation of their charter, students for the 20 to 21 school year. So we estimate that non-classroom-based schools probably enrolled north of 25,000 students for which the legislature refused to fund. Now, for the school districts that had growth, which there were some, not all, they got funding for that growth. And for school districts, get this, that were declining enrollment, maybe some of the ones that lost the kids that went to your non-classroom-based schools, they get funded for that phantom student population because school districts always get funded on the higher of the prior year or the current year. So we, on behalf of the non-classroom-based charter schools in the state, working through a series of class plaintiffs, filed a lawsuit and challenged this law with the state of California, not only for the 1 year, but for the principle of it. There's a basic contractual obligation that charter schools are promising to do. You are promising to educate kids, enroll kids, and provide teachers, which you did, and curriculum, and educate kids. And in exchange, the state promises to fund you. And we think there's a strong contractual argument to be made with the state. There's also statutory and constitutional arguments. The trial court disagreed, and we are on appeal to the Third District Court of Appeal. We filed our opening briefs. We think this case will be argued sometime in the spring. And so we'll obviously keep you all up to date on that.
And that cost us, incidentally, $4 million.
Loss of funding, right? Was that in loss of funding or the expense to educate the kids you didn't get funded for?
Lynn, was it?
It's over. Yeah. It's for the loss of funding, not being funded for growth. It's over $4 million.
Right. And our argument in the relief we're seeking is full reimbursement for all actual enrollment in the year in question. It's never happened in 200 years of public school history in the state of California, as far as we're aware, that the state did not fund a student. And so our hashtag is fund all students before the court. Now, this is a little troublesome. Oh, sorry, Mary.
This is particularly important, not just because of the money, but because of the concept. If in fact California moves to an enrollment-based funding, which I hope they do, then the type of school, the mode of delivery should become irrelevant. That would take all the discussion out about is non-classroom based funded or is it not funded? Is magnet funded? Is not funded? Da, da. If every school is based simply on enrollment, which would therefore mean that the student is carrying with them a specified amount of funding, which their parents or guardians or caretakers pay into the tax system for, then all this other discussion could become mute. So this is really very important in terms of the kind of reforms that we might see coming forward. We've got to acknowledge that no matter what mode of delivery you have, as long as you're meeting the criteria for being a school that is safe and that is delivering reasonable outcomes for students and is financially viable, meets the criteria of school, then the mode of delivery should be irrelevant.
I wholeheartedly agree. And the concept in state law has always been the money follows the child. The concept of competition, vigorous competition in the public school system to which charter schools are supposed to create to improve all public education is lost if the money doesn't follow the child. And worse yet, is distorted if the money stays with the school district and the charter school has to pay the cost and expense of educating the child. So it was really a defective legislative attempt we ended up with a $85 billion budget surplus too. So there was really no fiscal reason why the state should have cut off funding. Anyway,
there's another reason too. I won't get into it. Too much detail. Never mind.
All right. As most of you know, we have a no-fault system for employee injuries in the workplace through workers' compensation. So if someone's injured in the workplace, their sole remedy is to pursue a workers' comp claim through the organization, through insurance, through workers' comp system. There have been over the years some very, very limited exceptions to that. Now, there's a case, the Matilde case versus See's Candy, which is creating some concern among the defense bar because the court announced another exception to that exclusive remedy where the employees claimed that as an employee got COVID, brought it home, passed on to her 70-year-old husband, died, and that the allegation is that the wrongful death was effectively caused by their seized candies, failure to implement sufficient health and safety protocols in the workplace. There are also lawsuits against Safeway and other major brands based upon similar arguments where in their warehouses, they allegedly posted misinformation, in fact, about wearing a mask and vaccinations and things like that. And so the problem here, and this case is up on appeal, is that where liability in the state of California and your policies, your workers' comp and your general liability policies have all been predicated upon a belief that workers' comp would insulate most of those types of risks, those policies will have to be substantially reevaluated and probably the premiums will go up. But more importantly, it focuses workplace safety a little more, the issues of workplace safety a little more strongly on the organization. So as it relates to COVID and the continuing risk, it's not, no one I think would argue that we're completely out of the woods on COVID. And so, we're seeing more new strains and more we may need to see peaks in the fall. So the idea here is to make sure you're following state and county local ordinance rules and regulations and establishing to the best extent you can and still meet your goals and objectives as an educational organization, safety protocols to mitigate those risks.
How does that work with, for example, Patrick Henry, or I understand Scripps, where 50%, well, Patrick Henry, 50% of the students were out because of the flu. Could someone actually sue them by saying that whatever their processes and procedures and protocols were, they weren't sufficient because 50% of the school got sick?
Yeah, that's where we're going.
Based on that?
That's where we're going. That's some of the arguments that are being made are arguments very much like that, It's usually based on a reasonable person standard, though, Mary. The only way you'd be able to argue that negligence in that situation occurs where the organization failed to take steps when they were on notice that were reasonable and affordable and consistent with their educational purpose and design. So I don't know any of the real detailed facts. I saw the article about the hotspot there. But if you knew and there was something you could have done, let's just say one of those kids goes home and their parent gets the flu and they die, I would not doubt that a lawyer would start to make those arguments to challenge.
So part of Mary's question was, these also apply to public schools?
Yes.
Okay. Because a lot of these laws, it sounds like they don't. And that's what I was curious about too. Like if it's just charter schools or it's across the board.
That same thing is going to happen with businesses, right?
Yes. Yeah, see, the cases that we're citing to here mostly come out of the private world, but because you are subject to some of these private sector laws, you are also subject to things like the next thing we're talking about, which is the joint employment liability, which is, again, probably not something that's a major concern for you because I know how you're organized, but there are a number of organizations, charter schools included, that have relationships with for-profit or nonprofit vendors that they allow the other vendor to maybe say in special education. There are a lot of nonprofits hire outside vendors to do the special education work. The cases now are finding that if the putative joint employer is involved, even indirectly, in certain activities, overseeing those vendors' employees, even though you're not paying them, you're 1099ing the vendor the money, you're not paying the wages, you can still be liable or jointly liable for wage and hour law violations in the state of California. So if you have any situations where vendors are serving your students, vendors are serving your organization, and they are closely interknit with your organization, it's something to look at by way of those contracts to make sure that the organization Adeo, are not exercising the level of control that the courts are now finding that could create a joint employment relationship. Because if that organization fails to recognize lunch breaks, or, you know, doesn't include certain information on the pay stubs and all the things you can do to get into trouble under the labor code, then you can be sued along with that organization by their employees.
What, one of our business colleagues gave us some language. I think we ran it by you, where we added it to all our timesheets, where the people filling out timesheets had to commit that they were going to take their breaks, their lunch, blah, 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 you know, no overtime, that kind of
thing. I remember that. I remember our employment team looking at that, right, to help make sure those, because that had, there's a whole other series of law cases that we're not covering here today for those wage and hour law claims, which are really hot right now in California. That's something that to definitely...
Right. Well, we were happy that that was proposed and we guarded against. In fact, it was one of our board members that proposed that. But what about memos of understanding? We have many memos of understanding with, well, for example, for our dual college credits, you know, our kids can go to, can take courses with us or at the community college and get actually earn credits so that when they graduate from us, they have credits for community college. But, and so it's pretty closely, you know, articulated and supported. We wouldn't be responsible for community colleges ignoring overtime and things like that, would we?
Unlikely. If the service is being delivered off site or outside your oversight and control, unlikely. It's those situations where the organization, again, for example, let's say the vendor is coming to your site to serve your special ed students, and you're dictating, you know, when they take breaks, how they take breaks. You're dictating that they be paid the same amount as your own employees, and you're involving yourself in the oversight more or less, or the conditions in which those vendor employees are working, where you have this joint connection that starts to get established. So. But we're happy to take a look at any of those relationships if you have any concern. If there's any degree of influence by Adeo or SSP over that vendor, other than that which you've negotiated in the contract by, you know, negotiations, that's where the problems start to arise.
Yeah, I don't think so. Thank you.
I'll let Kayla jump in on this.
All right, we're going to move on to a few cases about student rights and operations. The first one is one that you may have actually heard about. It got a lot of press coverage because it's one of those rare times where the Supreme Court actually takes up an issue specifically involving students in schools. So in this case, a student tried out and failed to make her high school's varsity cheer team. She instead made the junior varsity team, and then it was the weekend, she was away from school. She posted a picture of herself or a video of herself on social media that had all these profanities about school and cheer and everything else. The post was visible to about 250 people, many of whom were students, some of who were other cheerleaders. So naturally the administration found out about it and they suspended the student from cheerleading. They said that she violated the school's social media policy and the cheerleading code of conduct. Parents of the school, in turn, sued, alleging wrongful punishment for constitutionally protected speech. As you'll see, the Supreme Court held 8-1 in favor of the student. And they made it in this decision, they made it clear that just because a student is a student, they don't shred their constitutional rights. They still have these freedom of speech rights they don't go away. The court also had this interesting quote. They said that because the school itself actually has an interest in protecting this unpopular speech, these unpopular expressions, because America's public schools are, is what they said, the nurseries of democracy. So they're saying that the schools should be encouraging students to speak their minds. They also did mention here, because of this, you know, because schools are supposed to be the area where they can do that and do that freely. I do want to mention, they also did make note of the fact that though the cheerleader was saying all these profanities, she didn't cause any substantial disruption and it didn't threaten to harm anyone else. She wasn't going to harm the varsity cheerleaders. So the takeaway here is that while schools, of course, should be vigilant in addressing any harassment or bullying, that's not what happened here. And they should be particularly careful in penalizing off-campus speech. On-campus speech is a little different. The Supreme Court has previously upheld a school's ability to control vulgar speech that occurs on school grounds, but this was off campus, didn't threaten anyone, didn't say she was going to cause any harm. And so the Supreme Court ruled in that student's favor. Up next, we have several COVID cases. The first, another one you might have heard about, this case was challenging the Biden administration's OSHA rules. So the OSHA rules mandated that all employers with at least 100 employees were required to have workers receive a COVID vaccine. So the workers had to be vaccinated or else wear a mask and be subject to weekly testing. And the sole issue in this case was whether OSHA exceeded its authority in promulgating this rule. And as we'll see on the next slide, the Supreme Court found that they did. They said Congress created OSHA to set these workplace safety standards and that this challenged rule goes well beyond that and is effectively a broad public health measure. So they invalidated the rule, stating that it exceeded OSHA's authority. Of course, this was just a narrow issue, the scope of OSHA's authority. So nothing in the ruling constrained states or constrained individual employers in this ruling from implementing their own vaccine mandates. The separate issue that school districts and charter schools have been facing in the past year is whether they have the legal authority to implement their own vaccine policies, their own vaccine mandates. We know that the Health and Safety Code in California provides this scheme under which, through the legislature as well as the Department of Public Health, they can add required vaccines to the current schedule of right now there are 10 required vaccines. But the new litigation that we saw in the last year addresses the question of whether school districts and then charter schools have the authority to go in and implement their own requirements. On the state's vaccine mandate, that last slide, there is no statewide student vaccine mandate for COVID. We do know, based on what the governor said, that at least at one time there was some presumption that it would happen down the line. But you know, we'll see. He was pretty hot on this issue for a time. It seems to be waning a bit, and they've since said that any anticipated vaccine mandate for kids will be delayed until July of 2023. But heading into these lawsuits that I mentioned, the first that we're going to talk about is Let Them Choose versus San Diego Unified School District. So again, the key issue was whether the state's own law on vaccination, again, those are the health and safety codes that charter schools and school districts have to comply with, that say that at the point of admission to ensure that basically ensuring that students have those 10 vaccines on the state schedule. The issue was whether that law that's already on the books preempts or precludes school districts from adopting their own vaccine requirements in addition to what is required under the law. And in that case, the San Diego Superior Court struck down the district's vaccine mandate policy on these state law grounds. Their policy required students to have COVID vaccine mandates to remain in in-person learning, and the court decided, interpreting the legislative history of the vaccine laws, that it was reflecting the intent of the legislator to occupy this entire field, and therefore it just left no room for the district to come in and do that.
So just so I'm clear, that they can require students to have flu vaccinations and all the stuff that's on the standard list, but not COVID.
Correct. Yeah, the 10 on the standard list, they have to for, you know, the in-person instruction. There's some differences for not in-person, but so San Diego, the district has actually appealed this. It's my understanding that it has been fully briefed and just awaits scheduling. GF versus LAUSD, another district one. Just to give you a little bit of context on this one, there was an earlier case, Children's Health Defense versus the same district, LAUSD, and the trial court actually ruled in favor of LAUSD's student vaccine mandate. They noted that the vaccine mandate did not actually require students to receive the COVID vaccine, but instead proposed to physically exclude unvaccinated children from receiving in-person instruction. Then in July, we had this case, the hearing or the decision on this case, the hearing was in April, regarding the same subject matter. The same Los Angeles Superior Court judge here granted a petition that barred LAUSD from implementing its student vaccine mandate. Here, one difference was it was brought by an LAUSD student as opposed to this Children's Health kind of coalition. But the court also in that case noted that in the earlier case, Children's Health Defense, the court had been persuaded that the vaccine mandate merely addressed the method of instruction. So it gave them an out. And so it didn't conflict with existing law. However, here, the petitioner's evidence in the new case actually effectively persuaded the court that the vaccine mandate dictates which students may be enrolled in a particular school within LAUSD and the curriculum, the specific curriculum that those students may receive. So as such, the court concluded that the vaccine mandate did exceed the authority. The last one here on the COVID front is the charter vaccine ones. Most relevant for all our purposes, we handled the two legal challenges to charter schools' vaccine mandates. They were against Granada Hills Charter School and New West Charter School. Both set vaccine policies that require their students over a certain age to be vaccinated against COVID to remain in in-person instruction, similar to how the others were structured. And their policies were challenged by the same coalition, the same entity that won in San Diego Unified. So it was this Let Them Breathe group. Here, unlike what happened in San Diego and LAUSD, the court did uphold the validity of the two charter schools' vaccine policies. And in their decision, they recognized I really like this decision for this reason. They recognized the authority of charter schools to adopt campus-wide health and safety policies that serve their students. So I think the most important takeaway is that it's a decision recognizing charter schools' broad discretion in setting policies that make sense for them, that make sense for their students, make sense for their campuses, their instructional programming, vaccine related or not. It's a key part of the Charter Schools Act, right? That's returned to the idea that charters were born out of in the first place, this increased flexibility.
Just FYI, I've been asked about flu shots. Flu shots are not among the 10 required in immunizations that students are have to have.
Yeah, correct. Mumps, rubella. It's all the real polio, the real
polio
stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So moving away from some of the cases, just to some of the recent trends in the law, we'll try to get this to wrap up pretty quickly. I'll go through some of these slides quickly. Mary, you let us know. I think we're approaching the 2-hour time. Some of these other slides at the end are fairly self-explanatory, but you know, there's a ban on for-profit operation in charter schools. You can't have for-profit operators operating charter schools. We were hoping that was going to be enough of a win for the legislature to get the legislature to ease up on charter schools. There were not a lot of for-profit operators left in the state of California. There were only a couple, but you can't be managed or controlled by a for-profit operator either. There was a charter school that got non-renewed last year based upon their over-inclusion of a for-profit operator in their management structure. Nothing I'm worried about for you guys. There are audit issues that continue to plague charter schools. This is just an example of a non-classroom-based charter school that was audited by the state for use of its Common Core funds. And the even though everybody recognized that ultimately at the end of the day, the school used the funds for the types of purchases the funds were intended to be used for, the way they got booked initially was wrong. And the auditor had to go back and amend the audit to reflect that these other expenditures actually qualified. And the state is trying to disallow the entire $2 million. Education audit appeals panel is the place you have to appeal. Unfortunately, it's not a very impartial body. It's very leaning towards the state. They found against the charter school. We sued. We brought a lawsuit. And thankfully, the trial court overturned education audit appeals findings as abuse of discretion. The takeaway here is that, unfortunately, you may have to proceed in some times to court to get relief that you need for a solution, and especially as it relates to some of these audit findings, adverse audit findings. Now, I'll just cover this really quickly, Mary, and again, you can decide how much further you want to go into this, but there are a bunch of slides here at the end that touch upon masking requirements, changing vaccine requirements. Mainly, I think the things to take away are, you know, following city, county, local advice and guidance, obviously, in order to best protect you and your organization, your staff from both risk of illness, but also from liability. The orders obviously are evolving and changing. And you, for a while there, God, we were, as you all probably were going crazy, you had federal, CDC, state, and county advice that all seemed to be conflicting. Thankfully now, there's all a little more of alignment as we go forward. Obviously, I think things are going to evolve in the fall. They may devolve in the fall and the spring. And hopefully by next year, things mellow out and management of COVID and testing and vaccine issues is something we never have to talk about ever, ever again. The only areas that I think I would focus on here at the end are the insurance areas and your field trip policies, if you have any, about making sure your field trips are consistent with your own policies, and that you have making sure that your insurance carriers are covering the field trips, and continuing up with all of the, I've been down to your sites, I know you have a recognition of cleanliness and masking and that sort of thing around some of the sites. Let me think if there's anything here that's... The last thing I think I would focus on is, and Lynn knows this all too well, is that a lot of the funds, there was a massive amount of money that was pushed out through COVID and the pandemic. You've got the Elementary Secondary School Relief Fund, 1, 2, 3, you have CARES, you have all these programs, and they're all subject to audit because they all had their own strings attached. And I don't doubt for a moment that your organization and under Mary and Lynn's leadership and others, Tim's leadership, have been doing everything you needed to do to comply with the federal rules and regulations and strings that came, the prevailing wage bidding and different types of policies. But the point to take away here is a lot of these programs are being audited and are going to be audited in the future to make sure that the money was spent consistent with the proposals and program design. And so we just want to make sure that all of our clients are maintaining adequate records and have done whatever they needed to do to be able to demonstrate full compliance with those. And then just, I think this is a good point to wrap up on, and not something Mary, Lynn, Tim, or the rest of you need to know, but the board members, you know, your non-classroom based charter schools, it's one of the most heavily regulated areas in the charter schools world. It's also the world where any little procedural mistake can lead to big dollars in apportionment concerns and audit findings. So you've got some main point of takeaways here. You have to have a board policy and independent study. It should be reviewed often, updated often. It has to be in place before you can start claiming ADA or average daily attendance. In most cases, you have to fully execute an independent study agreement before you start commencing instruction and taking ADA for that student. There's limitations now in bullet 3 about how much synchronous instruction has to occur for anybody who's not in a classroom on a regular basis. You've got these tiered re-engagement strategy obligations. You've got certificated teacher obligations for maintenance of student records, daily engagement, time value, et cetera, and a maximum pupil ratio or pupil teacher ratio that has to be maintained. I know your organization is extremely well run and all those things are monitored on a regular basis, but believe it or not, we have a lot of non-classroom based charter schools that over the years have failed one or more of these areas and have caused themselves massive fiscal liability, which the state is very unforgiving about for purposes of reimbursement. So you're very well insured, and that is the end on more or less on time, a little over, I apologize. But thank you for the time in the last two sessions for this very, you know, more comprehensive, frankly, to your credit. This is more information than a lot of charter school board members and staff ever receive. All really critical information to be aware of so you can all ask the right questions and understand the landscape in which you operate these schools.
Thank you. It's extremely well prepared and delivered. Thank you to both. We really appreciate your time. It's huge. Why would anyone in their right mind do this?
Yeah.
No, it's all for the kids. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank Anybody you. Have any other comments or questions they want to throw out there?
No, it's a great presentation. Thanks, you guys.
Yes.
Appreciate thank it you. Very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kayla and Paul. All right. Well, with that, it's just about that time, everybody.
You have to adjourn.
So I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we adjourn.
And Waylon Myers, I second that motion. Or Christina, you can third that motion. Sorry, Christina. It's your turn.
I'm not sure you altered the motion or what just happened there, but
there are three motions at least, I'm sure.
All right, I'll call for your vote. So Laura, please.
Laura Barrero, aye.
Thanks, and Waylon.
Waylon Myers, aye.
And Christina.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Greg Haggard is aye. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you soon.
And thank you, Jim.
Thank you.